The Ethics Committee meeting will come to order March 2009. March 31st, 2009. Mr. Devo, this is our organizational meeting, and which we are supposed to hold every biennium, and if you would give us the organizational presentation, we would be appreciative.
Happy to, Madam Chair. I'll just walk through the flowchart that's in your materials. It's a chart my predecessor as Ethics Council prepared 3 years ago, and it still is up to date and current as it's the rules of procedure that you will adopt today are identical to those that were used in 06. So this is basically the complaint process and this committee's role in the process. As many of you probably know, it requires is initiated by a written complaint that needs to be signed by two or more members of the House, and it needs to name the member who is subject of the complaint. Within 7 days, this complaint would be filed with the Speaker, and then within 7 days of receipt of the complaint, the Speaker would need to forward it to this committee. At the initial stage, there are three grounds under which the complaint could be dismissed or resolved. And as you see, they stem down from the Ethics Committee box. And the first is that the complainant would withdraw the complaint. And if that was the case, then the matter would be closed, except in the case of the committee finding that the complaint was frivolous. And that, if that were to occur, then the committee would send a letter of approval to the complainant stating that the complaint was frivolous, and the committee would also have grounds to impose other discipline on the complainants if the matter was frivolous. A second reason,
Madam Chair, can we
Representative Smith?
Madam Chair, can we ask questions as we move on?
Yes.
I do have a question, Madam Chair. If the refresh my memory, if the complainants withdraw at this stage, but the committee finds the complaint frivolous and chooses to issue, and then does issue a public approval letter, is the member complained against named in the letter of approval, or is his or her privacy respected?
Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair, I'm not 100% certain, but I don't believe that the complaint would need to be named in the letter of approval or rebuke. It would perhaps be referred to if I were to help you draft the letter, I would probably refer to it as perhaps the date or some other defining characteristic so that internally you could know, but that if it was something that was going to be subjected to public scrutiny, that you would keep the member anonymous, although whether it was open to, yeah, so that would probably keep the matter out of the public attention, other than you have, because you wouldn't need to have a hearing, you wouldn't have the probable cause hearing, which is required, the next step, which is 21 days, so there wouldn't be a public hearing. And there are provisions within the rules of procedure that allow for you to meet with an executive committee that would allow you to exclude the public to take up sensitive matters that would deal with perhaps the mental or physical health of the member that's complained of, or and otherwise to protect a witness or someone else named in the complaint. So I would think you would have grounds to, if you could determine before the probable cause hearing that the matter was frivolous, that you could meet in executive session to approve the letter of approval, and in that letter you could withhold the name of the person complained of, and then the matter would not be on public record.
Thank you.
So the second ground we've already covered here is that even without the complainant withdrawing the complaint, the committee could meet and or agree that the matter is frivolous and would again be able to send a letter of approval on their own vote to the complainants. And then the third ground, which is actually a something that is applicable throughout this whole flow chart and the whole procedure, is that a majority of the whole committee may decide a violation with inadvertent, technical, de minimis, or may not warrant discipline, and in which case they may work with the member that's complained of to seek remedial action, or without discipline, or the other, and or the other option is to recommend clarifying a law, rule, or policy so that other members aren't tripped up by the rule and give guidance to people in the future. If, however, the complaint is not withdrawn or is not determined to be frivolous, the next stage is within 21 days of receipt of the complaint from the speaker, this committee must hold a probable cause hearing to determine if there's probable cause to either proceed or if there's probable cause to dismiss the complaint. If the committee concludes that there's probable cause to dismiss the complaint, the matter is closed and no further action is required. However, if the majority of the committee finds a probable cause, which is, could be, in kind of layman's term, is fairly probable that there's the grounds for the complaint are well-founded, then they would notify, you would notify the speaker and the member complained of. So I think that also gets to Representative Smith's issue that you need to put them on further notice that they are subject to a complaint and that things are going to proceed to the next hearing, which is held to evaluate evidence for and against discipline and make a final determination on the complaint. Again, if the majority of the whole committee fails to find by clear and convincing evidence at this level, for disciplinary action can be dismissed and the complaint is closed. However, if a majority of the committee finds a clear and convincing evidence for discipline, then they can recommend disposition with or without comment. And the range of sanctions that are within the committee's power as far as recommendations of the whole body include expulsion, reprimand, censure. And for reprimand and censure, you can impose require financial restitution, remedial or other action, counseling for the member, or the catch-all of other discipline. And if the committee finds that by clear and convincing evidence that the complaint is proven, then it would go to the House floor for a vote. And expulsion would require a two-thirds majority, and reprimand and censure would require simple majorities by the House.
Thank you very much. And from time to time, maybe once a year or so, the chair gets a letter from somebody in the public that says that you should do such and such to so and so. And Mr. Debo and I have developed a letter that we send back saying that only a member can bring charges. Only two members can bring charges, and action, if that person wants to pursue it, they have to do it in the community in some way. We just don't deal with those kinds of things. And in the last case, the individual wanted a meeting, and I even refused the meeting with that person. I didn't want to discuss it because it wasn't in our under our umbrella at all. And so I thought I should mention that because they did take that action, and we can send that letters out. Please proceed, Mr. Debo.
Madam Chair, unless there are questions, I don't have anything specific to add other than perhaps following up on your comment and mentioning that we are available to, if a member does come to you and say it, perhaps they have a letter from a constituent accusing them of some sort of misconduct, I would recommend that you not speak to them as Chair Murphy did in this case and direct them to their caucus leadership, in which case then they can come to House Research, and it's very common for us to meet with members and their leadership staff and walk through ethical questions and see where that. But as the member of a committee that would be basically judging the merits of a complaint, it would be inappropriate for you to speak with someone regarding a pending complaint, even if they haven't recruited two members to file the complaint, because that may not, they may be able to do that in the future, and you wouldn't want to have make any sort of prejudge the situation based on an incomplete record.
Okay. And the second item on the agenda is the passage of the Code of Conduct. And I think the last one that we passed was approved on May 27th, 2007. And that is pretty much what we approved 2 years earlier than that. We've had a pretty good record going as long as we've been on the committee, haven't we, Representative Smith?
I'm sure,
yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could, I'd like to ask Mr. Diebold about the Code of Conduct, because what is the function of the Code of Conduct? Is this our kind of our statute, if you will, that we would look to see if a member had violated? Because if it is, it's probably by necessity it's pretty vague, but, you know, is this kind of what we would look to if a complaint was brought?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, this is one of the documents that you are, the standards by which you're held to. There are also rules, the standards and statutes that require you to, regarding conflicts of interest, gift law, and there also, you have an ethics rule that the House has adopted. So there are, this I think embodies all of those in, like you say, general, generic terms, and the grounds of complaint would need to be stated with specificity in the complaint, but you are held to a high standard by this Code of Conduct and the underlying statutes and rules, and they don't necessarily give a lot of guidance other than behave yourself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And is there sort of a body of past decisions that we would look to, kind of a common law, or is each one kind of on its own?
Madam Chair and members, there are, within House research, we have files on all of the ethics complaints that have been brought probably within the last 30 years. And I'm newly appointed this position, so I haven't had a chance to or cause to go and review those, but those would be of, to the extent they're not confidential files, the decisions and actions of the committee would be public record and then could be used as precedent to guide the committee. Also, the board on campaign finance has a variety of opinions on ethical conduct of legislators. And there is some case law on the issue, but it's mostly through the board and then past practices of the House.
And I think also this came about, my memory, Representative Smith, at the middle or toward the end of the 1990s, there was a public group, I know it was headed by former Speaker Tex Stevens, and there was a judge or two and a couple other former members of the Ethics Committee that had served here. And this was one, the Code of Conduct was one of the things that came out of that group, I believe.
Madam Chair, two comments. The human brain has the ability to forget things, and that helps keep it sane, so I'm not sure I remember exactly that, but I believe your recitation is correct, and I'm not sure of the timing. Mm-hmm.
And I think this is more general than the first Code of Conduct was, because of a couple things that happened. in between that. That's what it's evolved. And the previous code of conduct I know had the Minnesota Constitution listed in the first paragraph also, but I think that's because the Constitution is in the rule, so I believe it was Representative Holbert and that took it out so that this was not being done with.
Madam Chair, on the passage of the Code of Conduct, I would move the adoption.
Any further discussion? All in favor of adoption of the Code of Conduct policy that's before us, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. The rules of procedure. Mr. Diebold?
Madam Chair and members, this is a longer explanation of the flow chart that I went through, and it gives more detail as to the specific procedures that need to be followed, but I think that the flow chart serves as the a very sound overview of what you're about to adopt and incorporates the key elements.
And that's a continuation of the rules that are in practice and that have been in practice for all the years that Representative Smith and I have been chairing or vice chairing this committee since the last ethical complaint. Are there any additions or corrections? Representative Smith, or Simon.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Since I've been in the legislature, there have not been any ethics complaints that I know of that have been initiated. My question is, at the probable cause hearing or at any of the hearings that this committee might have, are parties typically represented by counsel? Is it sort of like a legal proceeding in that way, or has it not been that formal?
I think it varies with the situation. I can remember one case where there was counsel. I wasn't chairing. And I can remember one case when there was not counsel. And I was not chairing, but I was present. So I think it varies on the seriousness and how committed the member is to winning.
Representative Lieberman, thank you, Madam Chair. Along those same lines, I'm not seeing anything in here that would give anybody the right to counsel. There is a due process section, line 2.5. But it doesn't say anything. Oh, yes, I'm sure it does. The member has the right to respond to all charges to be represented by counsel, so there you go. Call and cross-examine witnesses to introduce exhibits, to furnish with exhibits, documents, etc. So,
and I can remember the case that I said before, the counsel was there more as support for the member, but then there was another case earlier before I even got on the ethics committee that I lost the law. And that counsel was very pushy. Was like he was in court.
Madam Chair, can I add to that?
Representative Smith.
From my recollection as well, being through at least two full-blown hearings, I think it's clear that any member complained of has the right to confer with counsel and have counsel represent him or her during any of these stages. I think I don't recall seeing a probable cause hearing where counsel was present, but I certainly remember seeing the full evidentiary hearing when several counsel were present. And I guess I would just make this, I'm leading up to this comment, we're a committee, we're not a court. And so when the two sides represent their case, they have the right to make the same kind of objection civilly that they would in court. But the chair is the chairman of chairwoman of a committee, not a judge. So they can make their objections, but they're for the record if there's a lawsuit later. So I guess the committee chair's job is to keep the hearing going to its ultimate conclusion, but not to make any rulings that a judge would make.
And then there was a case of one case where the representative that brought the charges thought he was the lawyer. What? And he worked up to it. Anything else?
I'm sure. Did we adopt the rules?
No.
Chair, just for clarification,
Representative Szymanski.
As an alternate, for the information that was folded, in the decision-making process, do the alternates have a vote, or are we just here in the event of the absence of a regular member of the committee?
That's correct. All right, Representative.
Madam Chair, I move adoption of the rule of procedure contained in our packet.
Any additional comments? If not, all in favor of passage of the rules of procedure, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The rules of procedure are adopted. Any other comments? Let us go forth and hope that we do not have to meet again. Thank you so much for being willing to serve, however, because this is a very necessary committee, even if we don't meet, and your presence is very important if a conflict comes up. So thank you for being willing to accept that challenge. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Thank you, Mr. Chen. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.